Species unite.
We're the first species that has enough mixture of intelligence and capabilities to actually screw it all up. That is our distinction. You know, there's a lot of species on the planet who are now looking to us to say, well, okay, you're the first to be there. Do you screw it up for everybody, or do you figure out how to transcend this?
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with David Meyer. David has worked in animal advocacy since the 90s. He founded and ran AdoptAPet.com for over two decades, and then he sold it to Focus on Food Systems Innovations, FSI, where their mission is to replace animals in the food system. He is the CEO and co-founder of FSI and the CEO of Humane America Animal Foundation, and he is a nine-time world champion of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Well, David, I am so happy to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Beth.
You have a really incredible story, and I want to get to your current life and your current world, but I want to work up to it because I want to talk about all the things you've done before this, especially, you know, how you started in animal welfare and how you started your life.
I mean, I've always loved animals, like so many of us, and I had a dog growing up, and of course, didn't understand anything about anything. This was before, you know, spay neuter was even really known. And so she had two litters of puppies and we gave the puppies away. You know, that was life in the 60s. I always loved animals and was kind of bothered by the fact that I ate them, but I just figured that we have to. But it wasn't until I got into college that I really got a message about what was going on with animals for real. And that's when I started to become interested in seeing what I could do to help.
What was the message?
I think it was an animal rights organization, might've been PETA, that had a table with some literature at UCLA. This would have been in the early 80s. I looked at that and I took it. And I remember, thinking, wow, this is really bad what we're doing to animals. And I don't want to participate in this, but I didn't actually become a vegetarian until I took a year after college. I was dating someone and she was taking a year abroad. She was still in school and I took a year off and we actually went and lived in Israel. And she suggested, why don't we become vegetarian while we're here? Because she had had an experience where she had raised some chickens on a farm and then was asked to slaughter them and she didn't want to do it. And it was perfect time for me because like I was away from all my friends, away from McDonald's, away from everything in this weird environment anyway. So let's just eat weird food here anyway. But, so I became vegetarian and I was concerned that I wouldn't like be able to live, you know, in terms of my strength, but it turns out I got stronger. I got into better shape. And then within a year or two, I dropped, dairy and all the rest of it. And I have never looked back. I'm 60 years old now and actually training for a world championship in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in just inside of 2 months. So I think that my diet is a huge part of that.
You've been doing martial arts since you were 6 till you're 60, and you've had incredible success along the way.
I have 9 world championships in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I have taught alongside Steven Seagal before he was famous. I helped create with a good friend of mine, John Will, the curriculum that Chuck Norris's association of all his hundreds of karate schools use. Yeah, I've done a lot of stuff in the martial arts.
And all as a vegan.
All, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. No. And it's funny because I don't, you know, I think people should do whatever is right for them, but I'm always being asked like, how are you still doing this? And I just say, check your diet. And I have many professional fighter friends, UFC champions, Nick and Nate Diaz, These are guys who are just phenomenal, and they just become vegan because they think it helps with their athletic performance. And it does.
Is it a thing now in the jiu-jitsu world?
That's interesting. Many people know about the UFC, and many people have heard of something called Brazilian jiu-jitsu, which really gave birth to the UFC. The family that came from Brazil, the Gracie family, the patriarch of that family, Carlos Gracie, was a nutritionist, and he was vegetarian. And there's something called the Gracie diet, which is a vegetarian diet that many of the fighters, when they came from Brazil, observed. Then, of course, they got into American culture, and so that has tapered off a bit. But being vegetarian, at least if not totally vegan, has always been part of Brazilian jiu-jitsu and the Gracie diet. And certainly the vegan thing, well, what with Game Changers, the movie Game Changers, which is really good, people are now understanding that it's an option. Like, you don't have to be consuming large amounts of animal protein. It's actually not good for you, but it's also an option to not do that if you want, especially getting rid of the dairy. Because a lot of people are allergic to dairy, and it, you know, congests them. You get rid of the dairy, your athletic performance just takes a jump up. My wife actually is an Ironman. That's what they call anybody who has completed an Ironman, male, female, or otherwise. And she's been vegan for years and years and years. And she hangs with a whole group of vegan ultra athletes. And it works really great for them too.
And I think, I mean, I don't know the stats on this. I run ultras. And I feel like for longevity, in terms of like as you get older, it feels like the people who are getting older and doing these things, a lot of them are vegan. Like it definitely helps you do this for years and years and years.
For sure. But in terms of my animal advocacy, what happened to me was I had been a musician, actually. That was always my thing. I was going to change the world by doing rock and roll music. And I had a lot of fun and coming out of college. That's basically what I did. But at some point, I realized I think I'm going to need to like have a job here because this is not exactly working that way financially that I wanted. And the keyboards, I was playing keyboards, and that was just in the early days of keyboards getting connected to computers. And so it kind of drew me into computers. And so I became this little computer expert guy. And my day job was working in computers. And by night, I was, you know, playing rock and roll and doing jiu-jitsu and doing martial arts. And I had a tragic thing occur where a young cousin of mine, just a freak accident, died in Salt Lake City. And that had me up. Kind of left me up all night thinking. And I read a book called Way of the Peaceful Warrior. And the subtitle is A Book That Changes Lives. And it did. And I highly recommend that. It's written by a guy named Dan Millman, who's now a friend of mine, has gone up to write many, many books. But The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, I read it that night. And it just got me thinking about life and the world. And I decided I needed to like stop working for computers and devote my life to a cause. And I thought it through and I thought, you know, I think animals is the thing for me because I think they're the most, they can't speak for themselves. And what goes on with animals is just so bad. And it's really tied up with cruelty in any way. And so I decided animals would be my thing. And then it was just a question of figuring out how to do it professionally.
And what year was this? How long ago was this?
That would have been about probably 1990.
I ask because nowadays you say, yeah, I want to work with animals. There's options that you don't have to be so creative as you did back then. Right?
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, Beth, because I like got out the phone book. Yes, this was pre, you know, kind of internet days. Yeah, this would have been actually late 80s. And there were some animal welfare and some animal rights organizations locally. And I actually called one of them and said, hey, I want to come work for you. Do you have a need for like a really good computer guy? And they basically said like computers, what are computers? You know what I mean? Like they didn't have a need for me. But the woman I spoke to actually said something that made sense to me. She said, well, listen, you want to come work for us. Like, what do you want to do? Like, what are you good at? And I thought, oh, well, I think I'm a good communicator. I want to work for you and communicate. You know, and she said, well, what's stopping you from just communicating now? Keep your current job and just communicate. And so I thought about it and I thought, yeah, I guess she's right. And so I created this curriculum called Honest Choices. It was for philosophy classes. And I called up UCLA, USC, Loyola Marymount. These were sort of the universities in my area in Los Angeles and said, hey, I will come and give a free lecture to your philosophy class as an hour lecture on just animal stuff and how we treat animals and how, you know, and very non-judgmental, just saying, listen, this is our logic behind it. I don't think it makes sense. Do you? And the philosophy professors were perfectly fine to have me come in because I sent the outline. It looked interesting to them. And so without being paid for it, I started advocating for animals. And then it was a year or two later when a job opening at one of these animal organizations did open up and for an executive director. And I just knew, well, I had this because I had all the business skills. I had come from the for-profit world, and yet I had been giving lectures on the stuff. And that was sort of my entry into that. And then I sort of got to see the world of animal rights and what was going on at that time. This was at a time when there was just a lot of protests going on. And I did notice something at the time, Beth, that there were passionate people and they were doing things that made them feel empowered, but I wasn't always sure that it was leading to the goal that we wanted. It always seemed to me that if you're trying to, for any cause, right? But certainly for animals, you want other people to agree with you. And that's the win. Like if everybody thinks the way you think, whatever it is you is your cause, then your cause is going to do great. Your cause is going to win. But anything that makes people close their minds probably is not the best thing. And I felt that what was happening at that time was people were protesting fur and protesting this and protesting that, but it wasn't really changing people's minds. It was just getting attention. And so I ended up leaving that organization and doing something. I had some people that I was working closely with at the time, and we thought, you know, this fur stuff is ridiculous. Like, why are people buying fur? It's not like they need fur to stay warm. And we live in California, and it's just a status symbol. But surely these people who wear fur, who were largely at the time were women, they must like animals. Like, you know, it just didn't make sense to us. And so we met somebody in Beverly Hills who had purchased a fur coat and had been told that there was no cruelty involved, that it was just like in an animal shelter, like euthanized. And that's just not true. I mean, fur is, you know, the way they raise the animals that are in cages, or if they go trap them in the wild, they're trapping them with these leg hole traps. I mean, fur is just brutal, brutal, brutal. And we actually ran an initiative in the city of Beverly Hills. We got enough signatures to put it on the ballot for a vote that, had it passed, which it didn't, would have required that fur garments have a tag that's removable that just says, consumer notice, this product is made with animals who were killed, and lists all the methods that the industry uses. And it completely, of course, freaked out the fur stores in Beverly Hills, and it became this big contentious thing, but it was a real moment of education. Because we weren't saying people shouldn't wear fur. We were just saying, don't lie to people when they're buying fur about how the fur is made. Let the consumers decide. I'm a very big believer in choice. Let people decide and they'll make the right decision.
How cool, because you changed the conversation.
Not a conversation about banning fur. Right. Yeah, that's what everybody thought. In fact, PETA came out against it because they said you should ban fur. You know, this is just giving people like a right to know information. We said it was like, you know, dolphin safe tuna, like just let people know. And if there ever would be a fur that animals weren't killed that way, you wouldn't have to put the tag, but all furs had to have it because that's the way all fur bearing animals were killed. And they really were lying to consumers. We actually went in with undercover cameras and documented every single fur store in Beverly Hills, telling a very fake story about like how the treatment of animals was. So I felt very justified in helping work on that one.
I mean, it's so smart. Most people who do go vegan or vegetarian don't go vegan or vegetarian because someone yelled at them or told them they were wrong. They go because they learn. Information gets revealed to them and something's open in them when it happens and there's a moment. But that's most people, at least that I know.
My thoughts on this, Beth, is that I remember I grew up, I didn't grow up vegan, but I was a nice person. I think I was a good person. I did a lot of good things. And I loved animals. Yeah. I had dogs and I didn't want to do harm to animals. And I didn't support factory farming or anything. I just didn't know. And so it helps me to remember that the me before I, you know, came to this information was still a good person. I don't even like the term like vegan, because it's like you're either vegan or you're not vegan. Like there's nothing else that's kind of like that. Like, you can call yourself an environmentalist, but it's not like, well, hang on a second, Do you drive a car? Then you can't be called an environmentalist. You're only environmentalist if you like live at home and grow your own food and, you know, live off the grid or something like that. No, you can call yourself an environmentalist if you care about environment. Like, it doesn't make sense for me to say, okay, if you eat one egg every 3 weeks, you are not a vegan. You're in the same class as people who eat, you know, bacon, eggs, and steak 3 times a day. It's like, no, you're like way closer to being like, so I don't like when people use words, because I think I know people who've like tried to be vegan, can't be vegan. I just tell them, don't worry about vegan. Just be healthy, consume less animal products, see how it feels, and like whatever.
I know a lot of people who are not quite vegan, but they try. And so the majority of their life is fairly vegan, but it's very, very hard for them. For them, it's a sacrifice. Like, it's hard to make the vegan choice. A lot harder than for somebody, like for other people, it's just you flip a switch and you never go back. But that's not how it is for most of humanity. It takes a lot more effort.
It's a big deal because look, changing diet is hard. People have heart attacks and their doctors tell them like, you're going to die if you don't change your diet. And some of them still don't change their diet. I mean,
Right. Diet
is, it's chemicals, it's chemistry, it's brain chemistry. It's, hey Matt, you know this, it's culture, it's social, it's your friends, it's your identity. There are so many things that go around, you know, diet that it's hard to modify your diet in any way, let alone, you know, not eating animal products or not eating sugar or whatever. I think there has to be some driver. And for, you know, a lot of people, the driver is the realization of the intense animal cruelty. I mean, just incredibly intense animal cruelty that's involved in just your local Chick-fil-A sandwich. People don't even think about that. And increasingly for some people, it's health. And of course, the big one is now concern for climate, as people come to realize just what a climate disaster, but the footprint, the huge footprint of animal agriculture on climate change is something now that's concerning a lot of people, and it's only going to get worse. You know, areas like China and India, as people come out of poverty, which is a beautiful thing, they want what is the luxury, which is meat. And now meat consumption is radically going up around the world. Something has to be done about that. And that speaks to some of the current work that I'm doing with alternative proteins. But I did want to tell you the story because you had asked about Adopt-A-Pet. But after that fur experience, that was just a big fight. And I just had a few friends and I said, like, what can we do to help animals where there isn't going to be just like an enemy and an opposition? And we thought, well, dogs and cats, like, they're dying in animal shelters. Like, that's crazy. That's not really the word for a shelter. Shelter's supposed to shelter animals, but you know, they're overcrowded shelters, and somehow killing animals became the accepted way of dealing with that overcrowding. And I thought, we've got to be able to solve this. And so I and a few friends spent some time, really a year, looking at this problem. And we did this really great proposal, but just one page of that whole report was to create a better pet adoption website. And it was an aggregation of pets from different animal shelters. So you could just go to one place and search for the kind of pet that you wanted, and then go to the shelter or go to the rescue group and find the pet, rather than having to go from shelter to shelter to shelter. And that became Adopt-A-Pet. And adoptapet.com still exists today. And it grew and it grew, and it got to the point that we had like 30 employees and we had big corporate sponsorships from pet food companies. And it was really, really good. And Adopt-A-Pet over the years has saved millions of pets. But I realized that for me, I wanted to turn my attention to the issue of farm animals, because I felt like there were a lot of people, a lot of great people working on the companion animal issue in the United States, but it doesn't affect as many animals as farm animals does. And the level of cruelty is just off the charts with farm animals. And so I started getting involved, and our nonprofit created this program called Food System Innovations. And that's what I wanted to start to turn my attention towards. I also, at the time, had gotten married. My wife, Dr. Galena Hale, is a economist who was also interested, and she came to vegetarianism, veganism through environment. It just seemed like wasteful to her. She's an economist, right? We started to work on this together. And what actually ended up happening is our nonprofit sold AdoptAPet.com to Mars Inc., which is a family-owned for-profit company, you know, M&Ms, but they also own Pedigree and VCA Animal Hospitals and IAMS Food. So they're in heavy in the pet space. And we knew this would be a good home for them because they're incentivized to sell products to people that own pets. And the money from the sale came into our core nonprofit, which is now launched as Food System Innovations. And now we're on the road running, and that's what I'm working on today.
The mission, the goal is to replace animals from the food system. But how do you guys do this? What all are you doing?
So we're doing a lot of different things. We have sort of two parts to our strategic plan. One part is affect the economics of the food system. So how do we understand why is meat so inexpensive, especially in the United States? Why is government subsidizing it and people aren't really paying the real costs of the animal products? And what are the substitutes that people might accept? Maybe, you know, plant-based burgers, plant-based milks, plant-based whatever. And how do we get the costs of those down? How do we make those products better so that they really taste and function exactly like the animal products and have the same nutritional quality and get the prices down so they actually cost less? So any aspect of things like that. So for example, we fund research into creating better, you know, types of, we use the term alternative proteins or new proteins, non-animal proteins.
What about cultivated meat? So right now, I mean, it's huge. I'm not downplaying it. It is enormous. Cultivated meat is now being sold in two restaurants in the United States, one in San Francisco, one in DC. It just happened. But in terms of the bigger picture with cultivated meat and scaling and it actually becoming something that people can go and buy in a grocery store for not that crazy much money. I mean, from your perspective, how far away are we from that?
Obviously, you know, what's being sold now with these first two restaurants is being, you know, people are not paying the price of that. The companies are subsidizing that so people can understand, you know, the value of that. I couldn't guess, you know, 10 years, maybe less, you know, we are working on a lot of things, including one of them, a project that I won't go into in too much depth, but working to exactly on this subject of how can you get costs to drop before the demand is there? Because frequently costs drop. Once you get a lot of demand, then you scale up and there's economies of scale and prices can drop. But you have this chicken or egg, plant-based, problem where, yeah, but you're not going to get demand to go up when something is really expensive, right? So it's always this inching up, inching down, inching up. You know, it's expensive, but some people buy it, then the cost goes down, then more people buy it, then the cost goes down more. But there are ways using philanthropic or government interventions to look at the entire supply chain of something and understand why does it cost what it does now and what would have to happen to get that cost to a particular place. And then if some big third-party entity gives guarantees to every aspect of that chain saying, here's what you need to lower the cost, we will cover that. Here's what you need, we will cover that. And a lot of times it's just a knowledge that there will be demand. So if some external entity says, okay, we guarantee you that there will be this demand for this, and if there isn't, we'll pay you that, then they do it, then they lower the cost and they do what they need to invest, lower the cost. And if you do that across the supply chain, then suddenly the cost is lowered. And then the demand actually is there, and often the third party doesn't even need to do anything. So these are the kind of economic things that we work on for the system. The other thing that Food System Innovations does is foundational work. Like try to bring more people in to work on this space, guide nonprofits working on this space, give mentorship, give fellowships. We do a number of things to just try to really improve communication, conferences, things like that. And that's also a big part of what we do.
You do a lot.
Do a lot. I mean, it's, yeah, I'll tell you what, you know, we sold Adopt a Pet, and if you give a little money to a nonprofit, and we can be a little dangerous in a good way.
You sold Adopt a Pet, and now you're going to change the entire food system.
That is our hope, and that is our plan.
We sent an email out right after Upside and Good Meat were cleared for sale to our subscribers, and some of the emails I got back were everything from it causes cancer. I mean, they were like, you could see all the conspiracy theories starting.
So yeah. The incumbent industry is going to do everything it can to muddy the waters for sure. Right. And so It doesn't cause cancer. That's why the FDA approved it. There's no reason to think it causes cancer. Do you know what does cause cancer? Regular meat.
Yes. And it's on the carcinogen list.
It's really concerning to me, though, with regards to the cultivated meat, because people really don't understand. You know, you hear this term lab-grown meat or something like, I got news for you. Anything that's in a box in the grocery store has come out of some lab somewhere. There's food scientists, labs creating your Coca-Cola and your French fries, and the oils. Like, there's food scientists everywhere. All that stuff kind of came out of a lab. Talk about like the ingredient list of regular meat to understand, okay, let's think about this. We've turned animals into meat-making machines. Meat is muscle. Muscle and fat and veins. That's what meat is. And we feed animals vegetables and grains, and their body is a factory, and their body then turns that into muscle. They're also, of course, consuming pesticides. They're also being given growth hormones. They're also being given these antibiotics. Then we kill the animal. Okay, so that there's blood and there's contamination from feces. And this is the process in which animals are made. It's just true. And that is the intense processing that creates meat. What's happening with cultivated meat is we say, time out. Can we take a cell from an animal and can we use that to grow in a food production facility the food that we actually want? No feces. No salmonella, no antibiotics, no growth hormones, no eyeballs being grown, no tails, no babies, no cruelty, none of it. Let's just create what we want. Ancient people used animals for what they needed. Modern, smart people with a planet that's going to have 10 billion people, we are smart enough to create the things that we want, but using things that are sustainable and don't cause all of these problems. It's a no-brainer.
I like it.
So we support that and we do work and we work with companies. We also work to get legislators in the United States in particular to understand the value and the national security importance of this. There was actually a nonpartisan think tank called CSIS, Center for Strategic and International Studies, that just came out with a report about the national security and the economic security implications of alt proteins, very strongly saying we need to get into this because we're not going to be able to feed the world's population. There's other countries that can, you know, that can own the technology here if we're not careful, like China. We need government investment, just in the way the government invested in solar, which is now becoming so inexpensive. But government has to help make it happen, and that's the same thing with food.
So what has been government's resistance? I mean, they give so much money to animal agriculture. What's been the resistance with the plant-based space, alternative space?
There's some resistance, obviously, from legislators who come from places where the animal ag interests are very, very strong, right? So they will support that and they see this as a threat. But it's not so much resistance, it's just a lack of understanding. See, what happens with government is, I'm sad to say it, money is what makes the world go around, right? So people who know and who donate to campaigns and who know that's how you get in front of legislators, you pay lobbyists. So when you have a business that's making money, like, for example, the meat industry or the dairy industry, they have money to spend because they're a business and they're going to lobby those people. If you're just trying to advocate for animals, that's not an advocate for animals industry in that sense. I mean, there's nonprofit donations, so you don't have that kind of money to be able to pay for that kind of access. What's starting to happen now, though, is now a business is coming in. You know, the plant-based business, this is real. This is real business. This means jobs. They're employing people. They're paying taxes. And what's happening is now legislators are starting to understand, and then there's money. So there's trade associations. So now we're getting access to talk to both Republicans and Democrats, who for various reasons really understand that this is a very cool opportunity to create jobs. It's definitely a way to hedge, some of the power that China is going to have as they become, as they become just a global power. We want to own this space. This is American technology and we want to see America lead on it. And that's the story that all legislators can agree with.
I hope so. God, that's great. What about plant-based meat right now, though? Because it's gotten such a bad rap the past couple years.
Because the meat industry has paid very smart people, the same people who muddied the waters about tobacco, incidentally, and the dangers around cigarette smoking. They're playing from that same playbook. So they're just confusing things. So what they come out with is, you know, there's too much sodium or long ingredient list or ultra processed. They're not comparing it to the thing it's trying to replace, right? Yeah. So if you want to eat a super ultra healthy diet, you should just be eating a vegan whole food diet. That's easy, right? But if you want a good taste of a chicken nugget and you want to get the same levels of protein without any of the, you know, any of the cholesterol, without any of the growth hormones, and without any of that stuff, and much better for the environment, then eat a plant-based chicken nugget. It's fine. So it's healthier chicken nugget.
Totally. I mean, the goal to get animals out of the food system is a really big goal in terms of feeding what's going to be with 10 billion people soon.
Right.
It's a lot of animals. I mean, it's a whole new food system. So when you look at that big picture, because you say it, right, we're going to get animals out of the food system. I would love to have animals out of the food system. But what does that really look like in the big picture of how that happens?
Well, I can give you my opinion about it. And I think, you know, at some point you should talk to Galina, my wife.
I'm going to next week.
She looks at the big picture stuff. But I think, like anything, it's a transition, right? So I don't think we will ever, or certainly anytime soon, not be having people around the world who may have chickens at their house or goats or, you know, milk their cow or something like that. But in terms of the industrial animal agriculture, the mass production of animals, I think the way that happens realistically is you get a industry that is giving people the same tastes and textures, but in a more sustainable way. And that's exactly what the alt proteins are trying to do, whether it's plant-based foods or any of the things we talked about, cultivated. You get more and more people to switch over to those. They discover that these products are better for them and certainly better for the world. Those companies get stronger. The companies that are selling only meat products get weaker because they're making less and less money. Now, some of them may invest and become the other, which is great. I always say, I don't want people who raise animals to go out of business. I want them to be the richest people in the world. I just want them to do it without raising things that harm animals and harm the world and harm people's health. So they have every opportunity to shift over and move into that and be part of the proactive wave that's coming. So I think that's what happens. And then the animal industry goes drops in size and the plant-based industry grows and more people learn about just healthy, whole food, plant-based eating. And governments support that because they have to because of what's going on with climate change. They're just going to have to deal with it. And then they stop subsidizing the cost of animal products so people can buy animal products as a premium product, which makes it possible for smaller farmers to survive. Most smaller farmers, animal farmers, are high welfare animal farmers. They're the ones getting pushed out of business. But as it grows, this is the shift that's going to happen. And people are going to, people are going to choose things that are better for them and going to choose things that are better for the planet. And once that shift starts to happen, I think we'll end up in not too many years with a system where you can still get animal meat, from an animal, if that's really what you want, but you're going to be paying more for it because you're going to be actually paying the actual cost of it. And those animals will be higher welfare, but you won't really need that because if you want a great burger, you're going to have cultivated burgers available to you. You're going to have plant-based burgers available to you. You'll have just so much more consumer choice. That's what people have not had right now. Because most people in the center city, you walk in someplace to eat, there's just not even a choice that isn't meat.
It's amazing. I mean, this is really the beginning of a new food system.
I hope so, but it's not perfect. It's a long way to go to get real food justice and have people really be able to have nutritious food everywhere. But there's just, I don't see any other way to get there than the path that we're on now. I want to share a thought. I think I have encountered, pessimism, especially on climate stuff, for people who are concerned about that and feeling like, what can we do? And, even the goals of the Paris Climate, Accord is to limit warming to no more than 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the year, which is 5, 6 degrees. Like that's considerable, and it's not averaged out. So some places are going to be a lot hotter, and it's going to change the world. And it's not, these are not changes for the better. But the way I look at it is, if you get philosophical about it for a second, unless you believe that God, you know, created us, and that's fine, then hopefully God's looking after us and we're going to do our best as stewards. But, you know, we evolved from whatever, and we got to the point that through evolution, that life evolved to the point that we are the first species, us great apes, you know, humans that we are. We're the first species that has enough mixture of intelligence and capabilities to actually screw it all up. That is our distinction. You know, there's a lot of species on the planet who are now looking to us to say, well, okay, you're the first to be there. Do you screw it up for everybody, or do you figure out how to transcend this? And a lot of the things that worked for us to get us to where we are today are now not going to work for us in the future. It didn't matter before. It worked for society to grow, and, you know, and we could just take from nature as if it was endless. But now we've reached the point where we can't keep taking from nature as if it's endless. And the question is, will we be able to make choices? And are we actually smart enough to figure out how to make this work for the life on the whole planet? The way I see it, that was inevitable. If somewhere else in the universe, life is developing somewhere else, I don't know what they're going to look like. I don't know if they're going to have two eyes or whatever, but I know for sure that at some point, some species will develop enough skill and smartness and capabilities to be able to destroy everything. And the things that got it to where it was will no longer work. And the question is, it's like a question mark now. We're at a crossroads. And to me, I like challenges. I'm the martial arts guy. My answer is, you bet we're going to figure out how to do this. And we're going to go through a rough patch or whatever, but we are going to fix global warming. We're going to fix our food system. We're going to find a way, because we're not going to lose this. And we didn't do anything wrong to get here. It was all inevitable. It's like, write the script again. Anywhere in the universe, it's going to repeat again. But there's always going to be this first species that gets to this point that now has to figure it out. And that is our responsibility. We are there. This is our time. We came at this time to do it. And it's going to be our privilege to figure this out for future generations and for the rest of the animals. And I think people should get behind that and get excited about it and get it done.
I'm very excited about it. David, thank you. You're incredible.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate all the work that you do and the visibility that you give to people doing such amazing work, and to all the people that take the time to listen to it and care and find ways in their own lives to do something productive. We're all in this together.
We certainly are. Last question. When is the World Champions for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu?
It's occurring at the end of August in Las Vegas.
Very cool. Well, good luck. To learn more about David, to learn about food system innovations, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and you could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really does help people find the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I'd like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knutson, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Ayana Peoples, Olivia Deming, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.